I got some feedback yesterday that people couldn't hear, so I will try to speak up more today. But if anyone would like to move over here, there are two mats here at the moment. If you would like to move closer to me, then just go ahead and do that right now. Today is the second day of our July-August 2017 seven-day Sesshin, and it's the 31st of July. And we're going to continue reading from an article that we started yesterday called Shikantaza and Silent Illumination. This is by late Master Sheng Yen. It comes from a Chan newsletter from February 1995. Based on a lecture that was given a couple of years earlier. And just for those of you who weren't here yesterday, what we started off doing yesterday was going over some of the basics of practice, just from the angle of what the particular pitfalls may be of the different practices that people are doing in Sesshin. And so we covered posture and breathing yesterday, and also started into some discussion of Shikantaza, and took up this article. Hadn't got very far into it. As a kind of response to the danger with Shikantaza of falling into a kind of dead sitting, a dullness. And so we take up where we left off, where Master Sheng Yen was beginning to quote from affirming faith and mind. This is the chant that we do in the mornings. It's authored by the third ancestor of Zen, Sun Tsan. And he calls it faith in mind. And he quotes the opening words of Affirming Faith and Mind. And his translation is, "The highest path is not difficult so long as you are free of discriminations. The great way is not difficult for those who do not pick and choose." And this comes out in the other possible translations of this word that he uses: discriminations, choices, selections, or preferences. This is probably the one that goes most to the heart of this. Be free of preferences. He continues, You must keep the mind free from discrimination and attachment. The method in which the mind is kept free from discrimination and attachment is called silence here. But silent, then this is the silence of silent illumination. But silent does not mean the mind is blank and cannot function. The mind is free of attachment and clear, and yet it still functions. So, as we were saying yesterday, the mind can still experience things as being pleasant or unpleasant or neutral, but without the constriction that comes with then grasping at the present pleasant, or rejecting or fearing the unpleasant, or just plain ignoring what we experience as neutral, paying no attention to it. So it's this point that picking and choosing, the being discriminating, is referring to having preferences and following our preferences. continues. We also read in Faith and Mind that this principle is neither hurried nor slow, one thought for 10,000 years. This principle is the mind of wisdom, and from its perspective, time does not pass quickly or slowly. When we meditate or work, we may fall into a worldly samadhi state and feel that time passes very quickly. In an ordinary state, we may feel that time passes quickly or slowly. However, in the mind of wisdom, there is no such thing as slow or hurried time. If we can say there is thought in the mind of wisdom, it is an endless thought which never changes. This unchanging thought is no longer thought as we usually understand it. It is the unmoving mind of wisdom. Our particular translation of these lines is the ways beyond all space or time. One instant is 10,000 years. The mind of wisdom is able to apprehend that the 10,000 years that are contained within an instant, within just that, or within a breath, or an action. We can relate this seeing 10,000 years in an instant to our practice, in the sense that it is really vital that we are not in a hurry when we practice. To be in a hurry implies a kind of a mind that is stuck in time, in fast and slow. It implies an attachment to a certain outcome, an expectation. It's okay to have goals. Actually, we need them. And if we have as our goal awakening, that is going to give us a direction, which is really important. But that's an awakening without an arrival date stamped on it. This practice takes great patience, and it actually, we can help ourselves to generate this patience if we can connect with this goal, this very lofty goal of great awakening, because it's not going to be something that happens immediately. Well, it is and it isn't, and the awakening is sudden. But if we're talking about Buddhahood, then this implies vast amount of time. And that can help to put our efforts into perspective. If we set our practice within vast time periods, can bring it into perspective. Thich Nhat Hanh, he talks about having the North Star to guide us. And when we navigate to the North Star, we never actually reach the North Star, but it keeps us on course. And this is how having the aspiration of full enlightenment can help to keep us on course, help us to stay aware of kind of the big picture of our practice and our efforts. Master Shingyan continues, in the song of Shamatha of Master Yungche Xuanchue, two Chinese terms are used which can be translated as quiescence and clarity. Master Yung Che uses them in two phrases, quiescence and clarity and quiescence. They describe a person whose mind is both clear and unmoving. When an ordinary person's mind is clear and alert, it is usually also active and full of scattered thoughts. Quiescence of mind is difficult to maintain. When the mind is quiet, it is usually not clear, even in a samadhi state. But Yung Che describes these two states, quiescence and clarity, as well as clarity and quiescence, as goals. So these two sides, not just quieting the mind, but developing this crystal clear awareness, along with a mind of no thought. Master Xing Yin then quotes another great Chinese master, Hong Zhi, who invented the term silent illumination. And he, in his poem called The Song of Silent Illumination, he said, "In silence, words are forgotten. In utter clarity, things appear." Words are forgotten means you experience no words, no language, no ideas, and no thought. There is no discrimination. This, in combination with the second phrase, "in utter clarity, everything appears," means that although words, language, and discrimination do not function, everything is still seen, heard, tasted, and so on. One way of understanding this is the mind prior to thought arising. We'll come back to this when we talk about koan work. Someone told me that he uses the silent illumination method and he eventually gets to a point where there's nothing there and he rests. That is not true silent illumination. In silent illumination, everything is there, but the mind is not moving. A person may think he has no thoughts because the coarser wandering thoughts are absent, but there will be fine, subtle wandering thoughts of which he is unaware. He may think there is nothing there and so stop practicing. But of course, thinking nothing is there is a subtle thought. In Chinese, this is called being on the dark side of a mountain in a cave inhabited by ghosts. The mountain is dark, so there is nothing to see, and in the cave of ghosts, what can one accomplish? So this is getting to the real crux of the danger with Shikantaza, is to get into this cave inhabited by ghosts and get stuck there. So then, in this next part of the article, Master Xing Yin gives a way of working with Shikantaza in order to kind of counteract this danger. And as I said yesterday, this isn't something I've heard of before, but it is similar to what's taught in some Vajrayana schools when they teach their versions of silent illumination, which I have done a little bit of practice with in retreat. So he says, he starts off talking about posture, and we covered a lot of this yesterday. He says, first, your posture should be upright. Do not lean in any direction. Be clear about your posture, because if you practice shikantaza, just sitting, at the very least you should be conscientious about sitting. It is also important to remain relaxed. Next, be aware of your body, but do not think of it as yourself. Regard your body as a car you drive. You have to handle the car well, but it is not you. If you think of your body as yourself, you will be bothered by pain, itchiness, and other vexations. Just take care of the body and be aware of it. The Chinese name for this method can be translated as just take care of sitting. You have to be mindful of your body as the driver must be mindful of the car, but the car is not the driver. Not like this particular analogy. If you don't like thinking of your body as a car, you can think of it as a bicycle. It's much more sustainable. But the point he's making is that we have to loosen and dissolve the strong identification we have with our body. If we identify with our body, that's going to be a recipe for insecurity and anxiety. The body is a compounded thing. It's changing. It's uncertain. If we really look at it, we see the degree to which it changes all the time. And if we identify with this changing composite thing, we'll be driven by it, and we won't find rest. So this is really an important point to recognize who is the driver here. It's not the bicycle or the car. It's the one holding the steering wheel or the handlebars. So to loosen our identification with this particular form that we have right now. We shouldn't, though, hear this and then get into thinking that we're a mind that has a body, because at least our discriminating mind is very much shaped and conditioned by our physical experiences. But if we'd be wrong then to say that the body is ourself. Master Dogen talked about a dropping off of body and mind. Dropping off of the physical body, dropping off of the discriminating mind, the small mind. So the first step is just to bring awareness to the body. And then Master Shingyan says, after a period of time, the body will sit naturally and cause no problems. That's akin to what we were talking about yesterday about getting everything into alignment so that the body can just sit naturally, easefully. Now you can begin to pay attention to the mind. If you were eating, your mind should be the mind of eating, and you would pay attention to that mind. When you sit, your mind should be the mind of sitting. You watch the sitting mind. Two different thoughts alternate, the mind of sitting and the mind or thought that watches the mind of sitting. First, you watch the body sitting with little attention to the mind. When the body drops away, watch the mind. What is the mind? It is the mind of sitting. When your attention dissipates, you will lose awareness of the sitting mind and the sensations of the body will return. Then you should again watch the body sitting. Another possibility is that while you watch the mind, you fall into a dull state, like being on the dark side of the mountain in a cave inhabited by ghosts. When you become aware of this situation, your bodily sensations return and you should go back to watching them. Thus, these two objects of attention, the body and the mind, are also used alternately. So what he's suggesting here is a way to keep the shikantaza in a sense lively, and alternating between focusing on the body and the mind to help us from falling into dead sitting. When we come back to the sensations of the body, this helps to keep us in the immediate present, in what is arising in any given moment. And so when we start to focus on the mind, we can experience it in that same spirit of watching phenomena. We can watch the phenomenon of sensation, the sensations of the breath, the body in space, and then when we come to looking at the mind, we come to it with that same attitude of non-identification. We're not our minds either, just as we're not our body. So we bring a kind of detachment or coolness to observing the mind, and this can help us to just get into being caught up in our thoughts. But rather we watch the parade of thoughts. And at the same time, as this, become aware of the space of the mind. When we focus on the body, it can be helpful to also have a sense of the body in space, of the space around our body. And the sort of the way that's what we think of as the body and what we think of as space are kind of continuous. And then with the mind, it's the same. This, a bigger emphasis is placed on this in Tibetan shamatha, stilling the mind practice. One focuses solely on bodily sensations and on physical space, and then in another practice one focuses on thoughts and feelings and simultaneously the space of the mind. And some people have a kind of sense of what the space of the mind is, but in that practice you start off by actually purposely generating a thought and then examining what's kind of around it, and that what is around it and what it emerges into and fades away in is the space of the mind. It's a very useful practice because, again, just as we identify so strongly with the body, we often there's not even a sense of a thought being a thought. We've already identified with it and we're already believing it. Because we don't have a sense of it being a thought emerging into the space, having a certain existence and then dissolving into that space. I'd like to read a little bit from notes that I have on this practice in Tibetan Buddhism called settling the mind in its natural state. And these notes are from The Attention Revolution by Alan Wallace, who's a fierce champion of shamatha practice. And I have found his teaching and writing to be very illuminating, especially in regard to Shikantaza. He says, and I think some of this is, I haven't referenced it very well, I think some of it is his quoting him, and others is my summary. I think I wrote this myself, or it may have been given to me, summarizing what he was teaching. It starts out, where breath practice involves letting go of thoughts and returning to the immediate experience of the breath. In settling the mind in its natural state, you do even less. It is a practice of letting be rather than letting go. Simply allow the sensations, thoughts or feelings that arise to be there without identifying with any of them. Let them simply arise in the space of the mind. In fact, what you are paying attention to in this practice is the space of the mind and whatever comes to it. And again, then there's a quote that's not attributed, but I think it's to a Tibetan master, an ancient Tibetan master. Do not clutter your mind with many critical judgments. Do not take a short-sighted view of meditation, and avoid great hope and fears that your meditation will turn out one way or another. Let go of those of grasping at results. Whenever you meditate, bear in mind the phrase, without distraction and without grasping. Without distraction and without grasping. And put this into practice. If dullness sets in, arouse your awareness. If there is excessive scattering and excitation, loosen up. Whatever kinds of mental imagery occur, be they gentle or violent, subtle or coarse, of long or short duration, strong or weak, good or bad, observe their nature and avoid any obsessive evaluation of them as being one thing and not another. Let the heart of your practice be consciousness in its natural state, limpid and vivid. That's the end of the quote from the master. Without distraction means not allowing yourself to be carried away by thoughts and sensations. Let them pass through. Without grasping means not preferring one thought to another, not trying to control your thoughts or push them away, and not identifying with them. This is the avoiding picking and choosing of affirming faith and mind. It is necessary to learn how to be attentive to everything that arises without grasping at any of it. We often think we are not grasping because we feel quite peaceful, but in fact it is only that the mind is quite dull. This is one of the great dangers of this practice. It is necessary to constantly monitor the quality of our attention and to detect whether it is becoming dull or distracted. To be honest about what's going on. To be conscientious. Somewhere in his writings, Alan Wallace likens doing this practice to the way that a bird of prey will hover in the sky. You may have seen hawks doing this. They're just there, wings outspread, and just making just slight adjustments with their feathers to hold them in that position in response to whatever currents there are in the wind. And that bird is just, you know, it's just scanning, looking for I think it's hawks have 8 times the strength of our vision, of human vision, and so they can see a mouse running on the ground from that height. And so they're just right there, watching. Hmm. not reacting yet. Obviously, they will dive if they see something. But just the sense of holding the attention. In a panoramic kind of way, apprehending whatever comes into that field of vision. Or another analogy that's used is to be like an abandoned farmhouse in the midst of a field. All the doors have gone, the windows are broken, and all kinds of animals wander through that abandoned farmhouse. Bits of debris blow in, but the house just lets it all pass through. Comes in on one side, spends a certain amount of time there, and then just gets blown on right out the back. Ellen Wallace also quotes a Tibetan saying, "Let your mind be a gracious host in the midst of unruly guests." We have in our zazen all kinds of beings come to visit us. Fantasies, fears, ruminations, and they can be pretty unruly. But can we just be open? Let them in, let them have a particular life, and let them head on out. This really gets close to the essence of how we're working with the mind in Shikantaza. Master Xing Yin continues, "In the state where you watch the mind, are you aware of the external environment, sound for example? If you want to hear sound, you will. And if you do not want to hear sound, you won't. At this point, you primarily pay attention to your own mind. Although you may hear sounds, they do not create discriminations." So he's talking about when we get more concentrated. And although we can hear the sound, they're no longer impinging on us in the same way. It's like they just move out to the edges of our awareness. He says there are three stages in this practice. We start at the beginning and then progress to the deeper levels. So the first level is being mindful of the body, and then to be mindful of the mind with these two thoughts alternating in it. And this is, we were talking before about the mind of sitting and the mind or thought that watches the mind of sitting. So just being aware of these. And then the third stage, he says, is enlightenment. The mind is clear, and as the poem has said, in silence words are forgotten, in utter clarity things appear. When you first practice, you will probably be at the first or second level. If you use this method correctly, you will not enter into samadhi. Everybody might go, "What? Not enter into samadhi? Isn't it all about entering into samadhi?" But he goes on to clarify this. He says, "It depends on how we use the term samadhi. In Buddha Dharma, samadhi has many meanings. For instance, Shakyamuni Buddha was always in samadhi. His mind was not moving. yet he still continued to function. This is wisdom. Shakyamuni's Buddha Samadhi is great Samadhi, and this is the same as wisdom. When I said that in the practice of silent illumination, you should not enter Samadhi, I meant worldly Samadhi, where you forget about space and time and are oblivious to the environment. The deeper kind of Samadhi, which is the same as wisdom, is in fact the goal of silent illumination. So when he says worldly Samadhi, he's talking really about a kind of trance state. If this is what we're seeking, we're really, in a way, we're using practice as a kind of drug, a way to disengage from things. And so true practice, true realization, is something that is becomes active in our lives. It's not some special place that we go to as a kind of temporary refuge, but something that we can touch and draw on when we're under pressure, when we're in a stressful situation. It continues. What good is this explanation of silent illumination for people who are not using this method? If you are using another method of practice and you reach a point where it is impossible to continue, you can switch to silent illumination and watch your body and mind. For instance, if you use the method of reciting Buddha's name with counting and you can no longer count, switch to silent illumination. Or if you use the huado, this is the koan, but find that rather than generating great doubt, you are simply repeating your huado, you may reach the point where you can no longer recite it. You can then switch to silent illumination and watch your body and mind. Eventually, you will be able to use your own method again. Silent illumination can provide a continuum for you in this in-between state so that you do not waste time. Now, once upon a time, I thought, and I think probably this was generally what was taught here, was that really it was not a good idea to change practices. The thing was to just bite onto the koan. And like a dog with a chew toy, you just kept that bite there and tried to keep going. But now I've come to see that this can just be rigidity, not real. I don't know what the word for it is, persistence. It can be helpful, if especially if we get very tense or tight, to go to breath practice. That's what I sometimes recommend to people. If you're getting very overwrought, if you're clenching up around the practice, then just put it aside and do breath to get that sense of calm and ease back. And what Master Shenyin here is saying is if the koan becomes tasteless, if there's absolutely no interest in it anymore, and we can get into the state, and it can be very painful to feel this way, that we just can't engage, we feel completely stuck, then it can, going back to the breath practice, to its simplicity and immediacy, can help us to then to find the way back to the koan. And equally, if we just get to a point where we're not really even clear why we're doing it and what for, it can be okay to go back and remind ourselves of why we're doing the practice, what motivates us. Actually, and that's of course involves some thinking. But to do that in a contemplative kind of way, so that we can revivify the questioning, the work that we do. If we don't allow ourselves these, then the practice can just become incredibly grim and joyless. We lose sight of the big picture, you could say. And I think this is I've heard this now from other teachers. There's an article that Martin Batchelor wrote in Tricycle, which both Roshi and I often give to people who are working on what is this. It talks about how to work with this koan. And at one point she says, you need to bring the energy down and not tighten it like a knot in the mind. If the questioning makes you feel agitated, speculative or confused, just come back to the breath practice for a while before returning to the question. So I think this is can be very helpful and is something to keep in mind. On the other hand, it isn't helpful to chop and change practices a lot. If we do this, it's likely that we won't really get much beyond the surface if we're always changing from one practice to another. People have probably heard this analogy of like digging holes to find water. If you're wanting to make a well, if you dig lots of holes, you put a lot of energy into lots of different holes, but they all don't get down to where the water is. If they all are 3 meter deep holes and the water's at 5 meters, then you're never going to get that well dug. There'll be a lot of effort going in. So it just has to be not done lightly, this switching from one practice to another, but there can be times when it can be helpful. And if you see these other ways of working as being in service of our main practice, and ultimately in service of our waking up, then that can really be helpful. I'm just going to, since our time is nearly up, I'm going to finish off this discussion of Shikantaza and silent illumination just with a little bit of Master Hong Jura's practice instructions. This is from a book called Cultivating the Empty Field by Dan Leighton. And as Master Sheng Yen mentioned in his article, Hong Jura was the person who really articulated silent illumination practice. His dates are 1091 to 1157. He was a contemporary of Dahui, who people may be more familiar with, who did a lot to articulate koan practice. And this really is, I guess it's summing up a little of what we've been talking about today, but in a beautiful poetic way. And this little passage is titled "The Practice of True Reality." The practice of true reality is simply to sit serenely in silent introspection. When you have fathomed this, you cannot be turned around by external causes and conditions. This empty, wide-open mind is subtly and correctly illuminating, spacious and content, without confusion from inner thoughts of grasping, effectively overcome habitual behavior and realize the self that is not possessed by emotions. You must be broad-minded, whole, without relying on others. Such upright, independent spirit can begin not to pursue degrading situations. Here you can rest and become clean, pure, and lucid. Bright and penetrating, you can immediately return, accord, and respond to deal with events. Everything is unhindered, clouds gracefully floating up to the peaks, the moonlight glitteringly flowing down mountain streams. We'll stop here and recite the four vows. All beings without number, I vow to liberate endless blind passions. I vow to uproot Dharma gates beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I vow to attain all beings without number. I vow to liberate endless blind passions. I vow to uproot Dharma gates beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I vow to attain all beings without number. I vow to liberate endless blind passions. I vow to uproot Dharma gates beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I vow to attain.